I think we've had enough with the debates, wouldn't you say? I've had enough with the debates.
We love them.
Well, you love them.
More.
Well, I don't know if I can stand that many more. Or any.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is your broadcast, as heard on 90.7 FM in L.A., up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 FM KSO in Cozy Cottage Grove, out in Pennsylvania on 93 FM WLRI in lovely Lancaster, out in Hawaii on 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui, up in Minneapolis, St. Paul, on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. And of course, streaming coast to coast and around the globe on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Nashville, Detour Talk in East Tennessee, and of course, Radio Sputnik 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us for another thrilling action-packed adventure that we call The Bradcast. On Thursday night in Miami, Florida, the Republican candidates for the 2016 nomination for President of these United States held their 12th, count them, 12, Des, 12?
Oh my God, is it really?
Yeah, I know. And we have, as a 12th debate, we have covered all of them, I think. Seems like about 40 this year. In any event, the debate with the remaining four Republican candidates, Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and John Kasich, was the final one before next Tuesday's big primary election day, with Ohio, Illinois, Missouri, North Carolina, and Florida all heading to the polls in what could be a decisive election day for both Republicans and Democrats alike, as we discussed on Thursday's broadcast covering the Democratic debate in Miami the night before. Crucially, in order to keep pretending that they might somehow win the GOP nomination, Senator Marco Rubio needs to win his home state of Florida on Tuesday, where he currently trails Donald Trump, according to the pre-election polls. Though Trump's margin in those polls has been getting narrower by the day. So, you know, we'll see. And Ohio Governor John Kasich would also need to win his state of Ohio to offer any pretense that he might somehow magically become an alternative to Trump. And it's unclear how that would actually happen, even if he did win Ohio. Most of the polls right now show Trump with a 4 or 5 point lead in the Buckeye state. Fox News poll, for what it's worth or isn't, showed Kasich up by 5 recently. But as I say, it's unclear what winning the home state actually gets Kasich or gets Rubio, other than to give them an excuse to stay in the race and maybe prevent Trump from getting enough delegates to win the nomination outright on the first ballot at the Republican National Convention this summer in Cleveland, by the way, in Kasich's home state of Ohio. So it might all come down to what happens on this coming Tuesday, even as Trump remains the hands-on favorite, as we told you last summer that he was most likely to be. And as we keep telling you, the Democrats should be careful what they wish for in that. Trump offered another example of why he is so dangerous following the debate last night, why he could be so dangerous to Democrats. You heard him in our opening quote there during his post-debate interview with CNN's Andrew Cuomo, saying he's had enough with the debates, that we didn't need to have any more. And then literally just seconds later, he said that more debates would be just fine with him. Here he is with both positions in a single soundbite, unedited.
Somebody said they want to do more debates. I think we've had enough with the debates, wouldn't you say? I've had enough with the debates.
We love them.
Well, you love them.
More.
No, the ratings are very good.
It's great for the people.
I will tell you, Anderson last night got very, very good ratings. We're very happy for Anderson. I don't know if it helps me, but he certainly got very good ratings. No, I think they want to do two more debates, and I guess I'm pretty much okay with it.
So we've had enough, but let's do more. He will say anything. He will take any position necessary to get the advantage at any given moment without shame or apology. And the media will almost always stand there flat-footed, unable to counter his nonsense that he makes up on the fly at any time it's needed in the immediate moment, as opposed to the media figuring it out later on after Trump has already won the moment. In any event, Donald Trump's ability to say anything and be anything he needs to win the nomination was certainly on display Thursday night at the debate, as he clearly decided it was time to be and appear presidential as he heads to wrapping up the nomination potentially next week. So gone were the insults, the cheap shots, and the size of his genital jokes, but largely for him and the rest of the candidates, including the only real alternative, maybe, kind of, at this point to Trump, which the much-loathed Ted Cruz. They all played along in what was, for Republicans at least, their version of a substantive debate on policy. But were there any actual facts behind the appearance of that substance? And is it all too late for Trump's opponents anyway? Here to talk about all of that today are our two substantive and or large-handed guests. David Dayan is a financial reporter and contributing columnist at Salon, Fiscal Times, New Republic, Washington Post, and everywhere else. He's also the author of the upcoming book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. I think that's coming out in May of this year. David Dayan, welcome back to the broadcast, my friend.
Thanks for having me on the show again.
The book must already be done, right? You couldn't possibly be concentrating.
It's not a last minute scenario. I'm not frantically finishing the last chapter right now.
Good, because I don't know.
It will be released in May. You are correct, sir.
I wouldn't know how you could concentrate on anything, frankly, with all of this presidential election noise going on right now. Also joining us today, John Amato, founder of the great and at times hilarious crooksandliars.com, which Time magazine has described as one of the best blogs in the nation. He's also one of the co-founders of the Blue America PAC in support of raising money for progressive candidates, putting progressive candidates in office. And as if all of that is not swell enough, John is even taking time on his birthday to join us today. Welcome back to the broadcast, my friend, and happy birthday, John.
Thank you, guys. It's good to be here on this rainy, windy day.
Yeah, well, it's nice to get rain in Los Angeles at all, so I'll take it. John, all the candidates, but clearly Trump, were working really hard to stay presidential throughout that debate on Thursday night in Miami, or maybe we can call it low energy, if you will. It was substantive, at least for a GOP debate. I know you watch Fox News very closely, and we're following Frank Luntz's wingnut focus group on Fox afterwards. One of his tweets had said that throughout tonight, Donald Trump was scoring in the 80s and 90s. My focus group says it was his best debate. So how does a substantive, if I can use that word in quotes, substantive debate play among Fox viewers at this point? Are they happy about the more presidential tone of that debate, or did they miss the melee? I know you did.
Well, you know, with I always enjoy checking out Frank Luntz's focus groups.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because in his past two with the GOP, the last one especially, they were just beside themselves how horrible it was and awful and embarrassing. And they were just freaking out. Whereas the last debate, I think it was the Michigan debate with Hillary and Bernie, where we had Michigan Democrats in his group.
Mm-hmm.
And Luntz was in shock on how thoughtful and smart just the focus group was. And I wrote a post about that, actually. And he actually came out and he said, that they were much more thoughtful than the Republicans and not just running on this anger. So last night he was very happy to start tweeting and telling Megyn Kelly how happy that this group was, and their remarks was it was presidential. You know, it was an adult. You know, they acted like adults. And when you talk about Trump, you know, acting presidential, he really just had a scowl on his face for the most of the time. So I guess that's his idea of being presidential.
Yeah, I think that'll suffice. David Day and CNN lied about the start time of this debate on Thursday. They said it was starting half hour earlier than it really did. But that meant that we all got to hear RNC Chairman Reince Priebus announcing before the debate to the assembled crowd in the theater there that the party would support whoever is the Republican nominee, which is an amazing statement on its own that he has to say that. But he said that, and then he received this sort of tepid applause to the line that any four of these candidates is better than Clinton or Sanders. Am I right? And there was sort of some applause. David, how much responsibility is due Priebus himself and the Republican Party for the situation that they now find themselves in? And how much is just, the voters like Donald Trump and Ted Cruz the best, and so that's how democracy works, and Republicans are not to blame at all here?
Well, this one would be a good one for John to answer, because he is, you know, literally wrote the book on how these extremist ideas have been mainstreamed in the Republican Party. And so the roots, you know, we're seeing kind of a lot of articles about the roots of Donald Trump's rise. And it goes back many, many, many years. You're talking about the rise of Fox News, the sort of delegitimization of Democratic presidents and Democratic politicians. All of this conspires, and certainly the demonization of immigrants, the demonization of you know, a whole host of figures, ends up with what you have now, which is a party that is largely based on anger.
The reason that I had actually asked you about it specifically is because I know that you spent years covering all of the news as it was going on over at the news desk at Fire Dog Lake. And we saw for years, I mean, the reason I ask is because it seems to me that Trump is merely echoing back everything that both the Republicans and Fox News have been shoveling out to them for years. And now Trump is literally saying, yeah, right.
You know, that's absolutely true. So the idea that Republican elites are somehow shocked that someone who vocalizes all of the things that they've been trying to say in code for the last decade is suddenly popular among their rank and file is ludicrous. And I also add that just as a postscript to Reince Priebus's call that you know, the party will support the nominee. What we saw today is Marco Rubio saying to his voters in Ohio to vote not for me, but to vote for John Kasich, in a kind of game theory way of denying Donald Trump the ability to have a majority of votes, majority of delegates at the convention. So this game is still being played to try to come up with a way to stop Trump that is not even in the particular individual interests of the candidates in question.
John, how is it possible, John Amato, how is it possible that, somebody like Priebus or the other the leaders of the so-called establishment GOP, how can it be that they spent so many years not understanding where they were heading? I mean, David's right. This is what they have been doing for years. I'm still trying to make sense of this, their surprise that, what do you know? A guy who is parroting back everything we have said out loud for years is suddenly the front runner in the race.
Yeah, I mean, I think a little of it is denial and the fact that the grand poobahs, you know, they are very wealthy people who have always have control of everything and employees, and in a way they probably consider a lot of the voters their employees. And remember, back in when Obama got elected, he was such a powerful presence that he scared the grand poobahs of the GOP. And they're the ones that opened the floodgates that allowed the Tea Party to be formed, because they were so afraid of what Obama's speaking capability and his presence could do to the country and to their party alone, that they let these nuts into their house, and now they can't get rid of them. I mean, they should have been tipped off when David Brat won his election. That should have been at least, you know, even as much denial they have, it's like they took out the number two man in the House, Eric Cantor.
Right.
I mean, this guy was like, you know, some sort of a history professor in some little college that I think was granted from the Koch brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was based just on immigration alone. And remember, you know, with right-wing talk radio or AM hate radio, their whole shtick is to keep people angry. It's very profitable. So it started back in the day with Rush Limbaugh. But their whole gig, in a way, it's not about policy. You know, it's not, I mean, they talk about issues. It's not really about issues. It's about, in a way, keeping their followers and listeners angry, but also to hate liberals, to hate progressive change. And that anger, now you see it, it's been ratcheted up. As soon as Obama got elected, you just saw the vitriol, that especially the summer of 2009. I mean, it was just horrific. And this is what we have today, and all you have is Trump just echoing exactly what all these talk show hosts did about kicking all the people out, you know, that the Mexicans are rapists. But don't forget, there's another part of Trump's his charisma. It's part of that televangelist prosperity movement, right? In other words, you know, you're not, if you're rich, I'm a rich, I got planes, please, you know, I need another plane.
Yeah.
And they believe that if they're wealthy, they're in God's will. Sarah Posner wrote a great article about this whole effect, and that's one of the reasons why he's winning such a big evangelical swath of voters over Ted Cruz. I mean, it's disturbing when you read it, but then you can understand it.
Yeah, and that's what really gets me about the evangelicals. They're not really Christians when you prefer to have greed and success and money, and that is your overriding goal, the prosperity theology. But one thing I just want to say is I think that not only is Trump and the rise of the Tea Party a product of the decades of the media and the Republican Party fomenting with these whistle words that they use to get everybody angry and all worked up, but it's also shows the limits of ideology. Because look at what the Republican Party has done. Look at what the elites have done. They don't like their base. And what they've done is they've just ignored the data that shows that this is who their base actually is.
And let me get into some of that. By the way, that's Desi Doyen. I don't think I gave you a proper introduction. Desi Doyen, our producer. Thank you.
Oh, is that Desi Doyen?
Yeah, that's her. You've heard of her.
Oh, very funny.
That was Desi?
Yeah, she's very good.
Ha ha.
I thought I was a political gnome.
Speaking, she might be. Speaking of of policies of the Republican Party, I want to see if I can fly through a few of these quick ones here, and David Day, and I suspect you'll be able to confirm or debunk in short order, since they tried to stick to policy in this debate. Let's run through a few of these policy responses from some of these candidates. John Kasich was asked about criticism that he backs corporate interests over middle class jobs when it comes to trade deals and so forth, NAFTA, TPP. Here's a quick clip from Kasich.
Critics say these deals are great for corporate America's bottom line. How do you respond to the criticism that you've been catering to boardrooms at the expense of the American middle class?
We want to have free trade, but fair trade. When people cheat, when countries cheat and they take advantage of us, we need to blow the whistle. Trade has to be balanced, and we have to make sure that when we see a violation, like some country that dumping their products into this country, believe me, as president, I will stand up and I will shut down those imports because they are a violation of the agreement we have, and the American worker expects us to stand up. I understand their plight.
David Day, and the problem with these trade treaties, at least as far as voters are concerned, is not really that the foreign countries are cheating, is it? Isn't it quite simply that they pay lower wages to workers and therefore it's cheaper to produce stuff overseas and that costs American jobs? Kind of end of story?
Sure, that's part of it, but Kasich was talking about something very particular there, and he was talking about the Chinese steel industry that dumps their product on the market at very low prices and wedges out domestic producers, particularly in Ohio. There's a huge issue in Ohio. And Rob Portman and Sherrod Brown have legislation that actually passed to, you know, get rid of that kind of dumping. But that was a fascinating question. The whole first 10 minutes of the debate was actually kind of fascinating. And what it shows is that there's no way this Trans-Pacific Partnership is going to pass this year. Even John Kasich, who is nominally for free trade, had to hide his true position by talking about that particular issue, which has resonance in Ohio, and hide. He kind of wedged in, yes, I'm for trade, and yes, I'm for TPP, like in the middle of 3 minutes of talking about how we have to protect workers. And, of course, Trump and Cruz were just, they didn't even have to hide it. They were adamantly against TPP and the particular trade regime that we have in America. And this is actually kind of a throwback to where Republicans were 60, 70, 80 years ago, where they were kind of the anti-trade isolationist party. The difference is that these trade deals aren't really even about trade anymore. They're not about tariffs. They're about in securing corporate profits by changing national laws and smoothing regulations so that basically corporations can operate on both sides of the border with relative impunity. And the fact that Republicans realize that their voters aren't going to stand for this anymore and that they had to change their pro-business views is very critical, particularly to this policy, this TPP agreement that has to be ratified by Congress.
John Amato, there was a lot of talk about that trade and so forth, and H-1B visas, and you know, I could almost hear people turning off the debate during that first part that David Dayan found so fascinating.
I was riveted.
I know you were. But so my question actually is, does substantive discussion like that, John, for the first time really in a GOP debate, at least so far this season, it seems to me, does that actually help any of these candidates at this point? It feels like, you know, these people, these voters, they are here for the red meat, not for the substance at this point. What is the sense that you get in scouring your friends at Fox and Friends today?
Well, actually, I didn't check out Fox and Friends today, but
sure.
It is your birth.
Sure,
your
birthday, didn't. Yeah.
I need at least one break somewhere along the line.
I see.
But you know, it doesn't. I mean, it's the pundits, the TV pundits, that want to hear this substance, right? And echoing on what David was talking about, and the reason for this change on the trade part of it, I can't remember Ted Cruz's initial position maybe a year ago, but Trump is selling himself as a businessman, right? And I know how to make deals. All these, the Iran deal, you know, it's all you hear, bad deals, bad deals. I make great deals. So he has to go out in a way to say every deal, every trade deal we've made is horrible because they're not me. I only make the good deals. So he has to put down every deal. And you know, for a while, especially early, Cruz was being cagey, and he never went after Trump, and he just started parroting a lot of his positions because maybe he was hoping that when Trump would drop out, or if he would drop out, that he'd get his voters. So I don't know if David knows what Cruz's positions on those deals were, but I understand Trump's, you know, why he's doing it, and it is definitely a shot at their, you know, South African free market.
Well,
you know,
well, let's talk. Let me talk about let's get Donald Trump in here. This is him, his complaints. You know, yeah, he wants to make deals, but it doesn't seem like he even understands what it is that he is dealing with. And that has become clear of late when it comes to Common Core, these educational standards that are put in place by states optionally. He has, you know, described it as a disaster, and it's killing our schools because the feds have taken over our schools. That's not true at all. Here he is talking about Common Core last night.
What are your specific objections to Common Core?
Education through Washington, D.C. I don't want that. I want local education. I want the parents, and I want all of the teachers, and I want everybody to get together around a school and to make education great.
Okay, but just to clarify, the Common Core standards were developed by the states. Right. States and localities voluntarily adopt them, and they come up with their own curricula. So when you say education by Washington, D.C., what do you
mean?
You're
right, Jake. But it's been taken over by the federal government. It was originally supposed to be that way, and it certainly sounds better that way. But it's all been taken over now by the bureaucrats in Washington.
No, it hasn't. David, am I missing something here that you know about that I don't on this wonkery?
Well, I mean, what you can say is that there was an attempt, and this isn't necessarily around Common Core, but what the Education Department did is they put this thing together in the stimulus called Race to the Top. Mm-hmm. And it was a kitty of money that was for the states if the states agreed to changing their local education laws, particularly around charter schools, around high-stakes testing, around teacher evaluations based on performance. They would give up this money if they changed this law. And it really did cause and usher in this kind of revolution at the local level in terms of education laws on K through 12. Now, that doesn't really extend to Common Core. And actually, what's interesting about the education debate is that just last year, a new law called the Every Student Succeeds Act passed that devolves a lot of federal education policy down to the state. So this has already been accomplished. So this is the kind of thing where, you know, God forbid Trump wins the election, he can say, look what we accomplished. We got the bureaucrats out of your local education policy when it was, in fact, already done last year.
Yeah, exactly. Here was Ted Cruz talking about school choice, which came up as well. School choice, charter schools and vouchers, yeah, and so forth.
I intend to work to abolish the Federal Department of Education and send education back to the states and back to the local governments. The most important reform we can do in education after getting the federal government out of it is expand school choice, expand charter schools and home schools and private schools and vouchers and scholarships, and give every child in need an opportunity to access to a quality education.
What's so funny, John Amato?
I mean, if he could have thought of a few more things to throw in there, he would. Yes, and we're going to build tents in everybody's backyard, and we're going to have schools in those tents. We want to do that. You know, I mean, it's like, it's everything and anything. It's just a word salad. It's a big soup. Just throw everything in there, and it's meaningless. And that's what happened in a lot of this debate.
But Democrats, there's a lot of Democrats, African-Americans, urban Democrats, that actually favor, for some reason, charter schools and vouchers.
Right. You're now stepping into a very key debate within the Democratic Party on education reform. And I would say over the last couple of years, the teachers' unions, people opposed to charter schools are winning that debate. Even the president has pulled back on high stakes testing, saying that it should not be the be all and end all of a student's curriculum in the K through 12 arena. This is actually something that's kind of changing, and it's interesting to see within the Democratic Party. Of course, you have very wealthy interests, a lot of Wall Street interests, Michael Bloomberg, wealthy philanthropists like Eli Broad, who are very interested in charter schools. And that's because they're for profit and they would be running them.
And thank you for mentioning that, because these are for-profit schools. They don't call them for-profit schools when they come up in debate. They call them school choice,
right,
because they're very good
at creating. What Cruz was doing was the really the right wing of this debate, which is where he is pretty much down the line. He was taking the right wing view that if you give vouchers to every single student and defund public schools and allow it to go in that direction, that this will be a panacea. And what we know from empirical data is that charter schools cherry pick the best students.
Exactly.
They are not indicative of whether their education is better or better for students. So this is just kind of a fallacy.
Let me queue up really quick because we got to get to a break. But I'll get a response from both of you on these. I want to play two clips in a row concerning Social Security.
I was hoping we would get to
that. With Dana Bash claiming that Social Security would go bankrupt in 20 years. she asked Rubio about this. I want to play both Rubio's and Trump's response to this. Here's Marco Rubio.
Social Security will go bankrupt, and it will bankrupt country with it. Under my generation, someone my age would retire at 68. We would continue to allow it to increase the retirement age for future generations until it hits 70. It would be a graduating scale over a period of time. If we don't do anything, we will have a debt crisis. Only 17% of our budget will remain discretionary. 83% of the federal budget in less than 5 years will all be spent on Medicare, Medicaid, the interest on the debt. That's it. All of it will be eaten up by that. That's a debt crisis.
Okay. I will let both of you get at that. I suspect you're chomping at the bit, but let me play Trump here, also related to Social Security.
According to the Social Security Administration, unless adjustments are made, Social Security is projected to run out of money within 20 years. So specifically, what would you do to stop that from happening?
Well, first of all, I want you to understand that the Democrats, they're leaving it the way it is. In fact, they want to increase it. They want to actually give more. And whether we like it or not, that is what we're up against. And it's my absolute intention to leave Social Security the way it is, not increase the age, and to leave it as is.
Now, I'm pretty sure that I understood Donald Trump to both criticize the Democrats for not doing anything about Social Security and then promising to not do anything about Social Security. So let me very, very quickly before the break here, David Day, and then we'll go to you, John. Take your pick there.
Well, geez, Dana Bash showing herself to the right of Donald Trump on that, suggesting that Social Security is going to go bankrupt in 20 years. What, are we going to stop paying our FICA? Are we going to stop paying 12% out of our Social Security paycheck? There's no indication that Social Security is going to go bankrupt in 20 years. There would be, unless we make changes in 20 years, a lower portion of Social Security payments that would be able to be paid out. And the truth is that the real crisis in our retirement system is the 401k system, because what we have now is a system where retirees do not have nearly the resources to maintain their standard of living in retirement. When we switch from pension systems to these defined contribution 401k systems, that has caused a disaster, a looming disaster. And the only leg of the stool that's left, we used to have a three-legged stool for retirement: pensions, savings, and Social Security. The only stool that is left standing right now is Social Security, which is why we do need to expand it. And we could get rid of all the tax preferences on retirement accounts across the government, and that money could sustain an increase of Social Security such that we wouldn't have people falling into poverty in retirement.
John Amato, why they always talk about raising the retirement age for Social Security instead of, raising the caps on what it is that people pay in. What is it, above $250 a year?
$110,000 a year. You don't pay Social Security taxes above that.
John, right. Go ahead. This has been a bugaboo for a long time.
I basically fell off my chair when I heard Dana phrase that question, because she's using information from Pete Peterson's Committee for Responsible Federal Budget to attack Social Security. What the Social Security Department said was that there would be a shortfall in 20 years. We're definitely not going bankrupt. That's just a lie. She should know better, because she's an experienced political reporter that's covered Social Security since she's been there. That's just an out-and-out lie. In 20 years, if nothing gets done, I think the breakdown is like 75% that retirees would get. And which is not good, but she has to frame it as if it's going bankrupt, which is just a complete lie.
The
whole idea of just raising the retirement age, I mean, listening to Marco Rubio going to his family, basically saying, well, my mother, she's my mother, so I can't do anything to my mother, but I will screw my kids.
Yes.
It's just horrible. You know, the idea that people are supposed to now work longer and then get less money, and this whole idea to privatize it, as David was talking about, they're all talking about 401ks, and Ben Carson had some crazy ideas. It's really despicable, and in a way, this is when we actually need the media and debate moderators to actually do their jobs and to point out that these are just fabrications and lies, because now 15 million people heard that in 20 years Social Security is bankrupt.
Yeah, and listen, and it's not just we need them to point out that these are lies, but we also need them to not create the lies in the first place. I mean, it underscores that it ain't just Fox News that is out there lying to you. Here it is, so-called, you know, middle of the road CNN that is passing on complete and utter falsehoods. Here on the broadcast, we never pass on such falsehoods, but we do have to take a break. So we're going to take a break, come back with more of our coverage of what could be the final Republican debate. Who knows? In Miami on Thursday night with John Amato of Crooks and Liars and David Dayan of, well, everywhere else. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your broadcast. Stay tuned.
These super PACs are a disaster, by the way, folks. Very corrupt. I know it better than anybody that probably ever lived. I know the system far better than anybody else. And I know the system is broken. And I'm the one, because I know it so well, because I was on both sides of it. I was on the other side.
Hello from the other side. I must have called a thousand times.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com with our coverage of the GOP debate in Miami on Thursday night with my guests, John Amato of Crooks and Liars and David Dayan from Salon and Fiscal Times and New Republic. We talked about a lot of domestic policy in the first segment there. And it wasn't all domestic policy, although it did remain kind of presidential for the Republican Party. They talked about foreign policy, torture, heading back to Iraq, violence at Donald Trump rallies, and they even talked about climate change, Desi Doyen. What are the odds of that? So let's see how much we can get to here. Donald Trump was asked about his call to expand waterboarding, that waterboarding was not enough. We have to do even more than the war crime of waterboarding. And to Jake Tapper's credit here, is this the one? No, actually, this wasn't the one. That'll be a little bit later. But here was the question about waterboarding from last night's debate.
You said that the U.S. has to, quote, take out the families of terrorists. When it was pointed out that targeting civilians is against the Geneva Conventions, you said, quote, so they can kill us, but we can't kill them?
We have a law. This all started with your question on waterboarding. We have a law that doesn't allow right now waterboarding. They have no laws. They have no rules. They have no regulations. They chop off heads. We have to obey the laws, okay? Have to obey the laws, but we have to expand those laws because we have to be able to fight on at least somewhat of an equal footing. We better expand our laws or we're being a bunch of suckers and they are laughing at us. They are laughing at us.
Well, we would hate to be suckers who get laughed at. John Amato, expand those laws? The point was, it's not just laws. Those are war crimes. And it's not only Trump, by the way, who would like to commit those war crimes. Cruz, the so-called Trump alternative, is also in favor of waterboarding, as I recall. But it seems to me that Republicans have never come to terms with what George W. Bush did during his reign. But how much of that do you place, John Amato, on the Obama administration for failing to bring any accountability to these war criminals, to the point that we can, you know, have a Republican debate where they just, you know, refer to these things as laws, as changing the laws? How much is Obama accountable for that?
You know, there's a lot of progressives that are angry with Obama, especially not putting people in, you know, the mortgage crisis and Wall Street in handcuffs. I think in a way that might be more powerful, argument against Obama's big failure. As far as this, I'm not sure over the overall history of our country, but I don't remember one
administration indicting another one. Now, they were guilty of war crimes, as we know, and we can thank good old John Yoo and a lot of people that Cheney put in those positions. But these are the Geneva Conventions. These are treaties that we signed a long time ago. I mean, and it's interesting to see the military's response to these guys, where they've come out vocally and said that Trump and Cruz, we wouldn't listen to their orders. Just think about that, because one of the main duties of the president is to command the military, right? And for the military, during this process, to say that these people don't know what they're talking about, and we wouldn't listen to these orders. I mean, what does that tell you about these candidates?
David Dayen, as I understand it, and I don't know if you know the Geneva Conventions better than I do, but as I understand it, even advocating for torture, as they have been doing in these debates, even that is a war crime, as I understand it. Is it not?
I'm not totally familiar with that, but what I would say is that, you know, we talked earlier about how the kind of rhetoric that the GOP engaged in is catching up with them. This is an instance of Dick Cheney's revenge. This was not just rhetoric, but policy that we mainstreamed this idea that the United States should not have any moral authority in war and should, you know, get down in the mud with other countries who don't respect human rights, and that we should use this, forget about the fact, set aside for a moment the fact that torture doesn't work, set that on one side, the fact that we would debase ourselves by engaging in such a policy that makes us no better than terrorists, which is explicitly what Donald Trump is saying, that we should be no better than terrorists. This is Dick Cheney's revenge. This is what he wanted. This is what he wanted his party to stand for, and he's got it.
Speaking of Dick Cheney's revenge, yes.
I was going to say, speaking of Dick Cheney's revenge, it sounds like something you get after eating at a really bad Mexican food restaurant, but yours is probably right.
Here's his revenge, that all of these, despite this horrifically failed war that we spent a decade in and that we are still in, you know, in many countries at this point around the world, the idea of sending troops into Syria, ground troops into Syria and back into Iraq, was incredibly popular at that debate last night here amongst all of the candidates. I don't think they asked Marco Rubio about it, but among the other three, let me play each of their responses very quickly to this question about sending troops back to Syria and back to into Syria and back to Iraq.
Just this week, the head of U.S. Central Command essentially said it's going to take a lot more troops on the ground to end the ISIS threat in Syria and Iraq. You have said you will follow the judgment of military commanders in the Pentagon. So here's a commander saying we need a lot more troops on the ground. Will you follow that advice and inject Americans again into what is, in essence, a metastasizing Sunni-Shia civil war?
We need to do whatever is necessary to utterly defeat ISIS.
Okay, I'll take that as a yes from Ted Cruz. Here's John Kasich being asked about the same thing. He's supposed to be the moderate, but listen to his answer.
Out of his mind.
We absolutely have to win this with a coalition. The Arabs have to be with us. You have to be in the air and you have to be on the ground. And you bring all the force you need. It's got to be shock and awe in the military speak. Then once it gets done, and we will wipe them out, it settles down, we come home and let the regional powers redraw the map if that's what it takes.
So shock and awe from John Kasich, and finally Donald Trump rang in on this question as well.
Mr. Trump, more troops?
We really have no choice. We have to knock out ISIS. We have to knock the hell out of them. We have to get rid of it, and then we have to come back here and rebuild our country, which is falling apart.
So, John Amato, what happened there to Trump's line that going into Iraq was a disaster? It's almost as if he's, Trump is making up this stuff as he goes along or something.
Well, yeah, he probably forgot his earlier position.
Yes. You
know? So he just said, he just agreed with everybody else. It is quite stunning. And even Kasich was talking in that whole clip about how, you know, he's talked to all these world leaders, right? John Kasich has been flying around
talking to all these leaders. They just don't trust us anymore. You know, which is insane. But it is a crazy position, especially, and a lot of Trump's, you know, earlier rhetoric was how, what a blunder George Bush's war was, and how much money we've lost at this, and that it's a complete waste, right? And now to send 30,000 troops, like where, you know? And also, the, you know, and I love Cruz, when he hasn't really talked about, you know, bombing him till they make the sands glow recently. But there was a big report that said that we've dropped so many bombs that we actually don't have any left. So, like, I don't know where they're getting these bombs. And I know David probably knows these figures, but, you know, don't we spend more on our military than, like, every country put together in the entire world? So I don't know how bad is our military. I mean, it's shocking the way that they just criticized the military when it was also their doing with the negotiations with Obama that stripped away, you know, a lot of funds from the military.
David, there was talk that Obama has weakened our military, that he's that's all Congress, is it not? Does Congress decides how much money is going to be spent on the military?
Yeah, I mean, there was the sequestration and the artificial budget caps. You know, the military found a way to get around that by setting up this thing called Overseas Contingency Operations, or OCO, and then stuffing a bunch of money in that and saying it's for the troops, when it's being used on all sorts of other things, weapons for procurement and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So weep not for the military. It's doing just fine in terms of money. You know, this, and by the way, Rubio might not have been asked the question, but he's the favored candidate of the neocons. So I would assume that he would put more troops than anybody into Iraq and Syria. At this point, you know, there was that great Atlantic, very long article on Obama's foreign policy, and really the takeaway that you get from it is that his main objective is to, you know, not do stupid stuff, and it's not stuff, it's the word we can't say on the radio. And that's particularly the case for him in terms of the Middle East, that we cannot get dragged down into another, in a series of unending quagmires in the Middle East. And that was the reason that Obama in 2013 decided not to attack Syria. And that was really a fundamental fulcrum point where he sort of went against the advice of a lot of the foreign policy mandarins who think that in order to have credibility, you have to go ahead and bomb somebody. Or put troops on the ground somewhere. This is a tired old ideology that is being peddled by these candidates.
Absolutely. If I could just one thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hewitt, who is basically the worst of the worst, his question that the president is supposed to listen at all times to his military leaders is beyond belief. And that's another trope that they've been pushing, that if you dare disagree with a general, you know, you should be impeached. And if we look at our
history...
If you
don't exercise your independent judgment as and the mandate given to you by the voters,
well,
to, you know, we're not a military dictatorship.
Far be it for me to defend Hugh Hewitt in any way, shape, or form.
I can't believe you talk about mainstreaming the crazy.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Hugh Hewitt is a respected moderator on a half dozen of these debates is absolutely stunning.
And for people who don't know who Hewitt is, he's a right-wing talk radio guy. And, you know, I noticed they haven't called me or, you know, any of the progressive radio people. They don't call the Young Turk. They don't call Cenk Uygur and ask him to moderate debates at CNN.
And they never would. And they never would.
Exactly. And he's not the only one. There have been other right-wing bloggers who have been Mary Catherine Hamm, I think, who have been questioners in these debates.
You mentioned about Priebus. This is all Priebus is doing because he changed all the rules for this whole primary process, and he forced the networks to partner up with conservative outlets. So that's why they shoved Hugh Hewitt. You can blame, you know, Priebus. They shoved Hugh Hewitt down our throats from, I think, Salem Broadcasting.
Yep.
I mean, last night there was a guy from the Washington Times, you know, this is a Mooney guy asking questions. it's beyond belief, you know. And this and Priebus has to be the most embarrassed person in the establishment behind closed doors because he set up this whole travesty. We thought 2012. I mean, I loved it, you know. We thought 2012. Nothing could top that. And then with his direction to try to change things, he's only made it worse. And I mean, it is
quite incredible. I gotta get to a break, which means, by the way, Desi Doyen, my hopes of talking to you about their comments on climate change, as usual. Climate change
always shunted off
shunted
to the
off,
end.
Off, yes, oh, well. To our next thrilling episode.
No, we will make laws to change weather.
We exactly. We will get to that, I promise, on the next thrilling
promises,
episode, Desi
promises.
Doyen. But let me take a quick break and come back because this has gotten so insane. The violence at Donald Trump rallies came up, and I think the candidates, other than Donald Trump, missed a really good opportunity to actually get in a shot at Donald Trump, but they didn't take it. We'll talk about that after this break with my guests, John Amato and David Doyen. And
no, I'm Doyen.
I'm
He's
sorry,
Dayan.
David Doyen, Desi.
That's a great new show. The Doyen and Dayan show.
Yeah, that wouldn't confuse anybody.
I'd love to take the week off. Well, that's what we'll do next week. All right, a quick break. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Stay tuned.
I was there when we reformed the Pentagon on a bipartisan basis to give control to the commanders in the field and force the services to work together. I was the chief architect, along with Senator Domenici, of the last time we balanced the budget, the first time since we walked on the moon.
If you believe they put a man on the moon, man on the moon.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. We've got just a very few minutes here. Finish up our coverage of what could be the last debate between the Republicans on Thursday night in Miami with my guest David Dayan and John Amato. Okay, the subject of violence at Donald Trump rallies came up about time, frankly. Here was, a shortened version of the exchange between Donald Trump and CNN's Jake Tapper.
Earlier today, a man was arrested and charged with assault after sucker punching a protester in the face at your rally in Fayetteville, North Carolina. This is hardly the first incident of violence breaking out at one of your rallies. Do you believe that you've done anything to create a tone where this kind of violence would be encouraged?
I hope not. I truly hope not. People come with tremendous passion and love for the country, but when they see what's going on in this country, they have anger that's unbelievable. They have anger. They love this country. They don't like seeing bad trade deals. They don't like seeing higher taxes. They don't like seeing a loss of their jobs.
Some of your critics point to quotes that you've made at these rallies, including, "I'd like to punch him in the face." In the good old days, they'd have ripped him out of that seat so fast. Okay, just knock the hell. I promise you. I will pay for the legal fees, I promise, I promise.
We have some protesters who are bad dudes. They are swinging, they are really dangerous, and they get in there and they start hitting people.
Okay, so, good for Jake Tapper for following up on a question after, you know, Trump had said, I don't think I have any responsibility, I didn't do anything, what did I do? So good for Tapper for following up, and B, Trump is full of it that these people are, you know, hitting people, bad dudes. John Amato, is there any evidence at all of anything like that to your knowledge that these protesters at Donald Trump's rallies have been violent or brought this violence upon themselves somehow?
No, absolutely not. And, you know, after the debate, Megyn Kelly had on a panel with Chris Steigerwald and Carson's ex-manager, Bennett, and Howard Kurtz. And they went through all the video, and they held the belief that you did, which is like, why didn't these guys, Cruz and Marco, go after Trump on this? And they all agreed, and even Megyn Kelly stuck up for Black Lives Matter.
What?
You know, because she knows that they're protesting, but they're not, you know, they're not causing physical violence. And with Chris Steigerwald, he basically really castigated these people and said that they whiffed, and he goes, instead of saying Donald Trump has created an atmosphere which he incites people to greater rage, by the way, which is true, that those guys didn't take Trump to task, and that was reflective of an overall weak performance on everybody's part when it came to holding Trump to account. And this was a big moment when they could have rebuked this type of violence and they didn't.
And doesn't it, David Dayan, doesn't it simply underscore that the fact is Donald Trump is the best candidate from amongst this group, at least as far as Republicans are concerned? He can get away with anything, it seems, and I'm going to ask just your closing thoughts here on my argument that while a lot of Democrats think Donald Trump will be easy to beat, that he could end up being as much of a nightmare for the Democrats as he has been for the Republicans so far this season.
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly a Teflon candidate. They're basically, what you saw last night was a bunch of candidates afraid to go after Trump. Because it has backfired on them, all of them, at some point in the past. And so they're all completely gun shy. Now, maybe that dynamic changes in the general election, but as long as the media loves to, you know, put Donald Trump rallies on television for hours at a time and minimize the exposure of the other candidates, this is, you know, he has a lot of ways to wiggle out of things. And it's really quite incredible to claim responsibility for violence happening at your rallies over and over and over again. At the same time, you're condemning every politician for everything that has happened over the last 20 years.
David,
it's quite an irony.
David Dayan, financial reporter, contributing columnist at Salon, Fiscal Times, New Republic, Washington Post, and everywhere else, and author of a book that I'm sure we will be discussing in the coming months. David, as ever, great to have you here. Thank you, my friend.
All right, thanks.
You bet. And John Amato, founder of the great crooksandliars.com. You can and should follow him on the Twitters. Oh, I forgot to give David's address. David is D. Dayan on Twitters. And John Amato from Crooks and Liars is, he's just John Amato on the Twitters. Hey, John, thank you very much. And happy birthday, my friend.
Thanks. And it was good to be here. And I will chat with you guys another time.
Much appreciated. My thanks also to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, and of course to David Dayan and John Amato. We will be back with you soon. Until then, you can find me by following me on the Facebooks and the Twitters at The Brad Blog. And also, you can drop me an email if you prefer. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Oh, brother. Good luck, world.